Oh my God, it's Kay Pearson. Kay Pearson's new album is Radios and Rainbows, and that was a great song, the single off of it, Evil Love. And Kay Pearson will be here in studio at the 11 o'clock hour, and we'll talk about Radios and Rainbows. We'll talk about her gig at the City Winery, Hudson Valley in Montgomery on May 2nd, and it'll be great to catch up with Kay Pearson of the B-52s, and we'll be playing cuts off the new album throughout the panel this morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. You made it to Friday. Congratulations. And we will celebrate just that accomplishment on this morning. We welcome you to always be a part of our program, to join in and to have a say as to what we're talking about. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us welcome our panelists at this moment. We say hello to Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Science, CICS, C-I-C-S.
And quite a mouthful, Joe.
Yeah, and faculty associate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Hello, Fran Berman.
Good morning, Joe. Two universities on the list. There you go.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, and we'll we got a lot to talk about. We got a lot of education stuff to talk about this morning. So we'll get into that in just a moment. Speaking of the former president of Skidmore College in the Spa City, Saratoga Springs, New York, Philip Glotzbach joins us. Also the author of the book "Embrace Your Freedom: Winning Strategies to Succeed in College and in Life." Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, Joe. Thank you for inviting me today.
It's really good to have you back. You were here a few days ago, and I was out, and I missed you. And I'm delighted that you're back, because I always love when you're on the show, and we have a lot to talk about, and I look forward to that.
I look forward to it also.
Thank you very, very much. We also welcome CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Very, very busy these days. Hello, Heather Mulligan. How are you?
Good morning. I feel embarrassed that I lack a university affiliation, so I'm
you're
gonna have
running
to...
the state, for
no,
God's sake.
I wish I was running the state. The people who are running it into the ground. It's like Thelma and Louise driving a car over a cliff. Seriously.
Well, it's exciting.
Oh, it's very exciting. But I don't know how you spend $100 billion more than you did 10 years ago. Do we feel like the government services have improved, like, vastly? Because I don't feel a doubling of
benefit. Did you say $100
billion? Billion with a B, yeah. $100 billion in one decade, the spending has increased.
I don't notice that in my daily life.
No, right? And don't you think you would? Or should?
You would think.
You know? Like, yeah. We should all be driving Cadillacs or, I don't know, something American-made, right?
Like, you never pay tolls. You never,
right.
You never pay a parking meter. It's just, it's all.
Exactly. Yeah. You wouldn't have, like, every municipality shaking you down for, like, maybe sliding through a red light.
Right.
You know? I mean, come on.
That's a good point, Heather. Very, very good point. I think we'll have a budget soon.
Maybe.
Okay.
I would say it will be a weekend thing, but not this weekend.
Okay.
They can't help themselves. They have to drag it out.
Well,
only a month late.
I wish you well, and certainly wish you peace when it all comes together and you can get it
behind
you.
I'm just going to curl up in a ball and cry.
All right. We want to mention to you, too, a reminder. We've been talking about this week, and we'll be reminding you a couple of times until then, which is Wednesday, April 30th. We're going to be in Oneonta. We're going to bring the show on the road, the Roundtable Live in Oneonta. This is all part of WAMC on the road, and we're bringing the Roundtable to Hartwick College's Shinneman Chapel House in partnership with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service on April 30th. Wednesday, April 30th, just happens to mark the first 100 days of the second administration of Donald J. Trump. So that will certainly be in the cards to discuss, although these are kids who are really talking about important stuff like local and state government, the intersection of those, civic engagement, legal education, and we'll be talking to a slew of students. We have a really great list of students who we'll be talking to. We'll make up the bulk of the program. And then we'll also be talking to the three co-directors of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Laurel Elder, Zachary McKinney, and Matthew Chick. So a lot going on. Wednesday, April 30th, we will start the festivities at 8:30. The show starts at 9. We'll go from 9 to 10:30 at the Shinneman Chapel House, Hartwick Drive, Oneonta. Now, if you would like to be in the audience and to take part in this, you can go to our website, wamc.org. Just click on the link, and tickets are $50 a piece. All the money goes to WAMC, and you may have heard that public media needs money, so that's a good way to do it. WAMC.org. So, yeah, what is that, $100 a pair? Yeah, that's a good morning out. Yeah, I think that'd be a lot of fun. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Okay, that is the announcement I needed to make. Let us start with the festivities and talk about what is going on in the world. Believe it or not, Pete Hegseth's still in the news. And, you know, this last Sunday, the New York Times ran a story about a follow-up to the first Signal chat story in which a journalist was on the call of higher-ups within the Defense Department and the Pentagon. And then we learned that not only was that happening, but apparently there was also a second chat that took place on his private telephone that included his wife, his brother, and his lawyer. Perhaps, and I do believe more important than all of that is the fact that the office, his office, is in a shambles, is in an absolute I don't know that it really has an office. Three people have left. There was another defection last night. And so there's this trying to portray calm within Hegseth's office. However, that does seem to be hard to prove in fact. Then the New York Times reporting this morning that Hegseth's personal phone use created vulnerabilities. The number that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recently used in a Signal chat could be found online on social media and on a fantasy sports site. So let me go to you, Fran Berman. That seems to be problematic.
Yeah. you know, let me count the ways that this is problematic. Throughout the years, I've gotten to know many very hardworking civil servants in the government. And one thing that is impressed upon them, or at least used to be impressed upon them, is the importance of the security of the work that they do. It's really important that bad actors, whether they be domestic or international, don't know as much as possible what's going on. And the fact that someone could be in that place and have such a blatant disregard or lack of knowledge about it is just amazing. So, you know, why is this stuff important? So everybody knows, and of course we heard it ad nauseum when there was all of this stuff about, you know, Hillary's email that she was inappropriate. That it's really important that government stuff happens on government devices. And those government devices have different kinds of security than yours and my devices. They have extra layers of security. They can counteract attacks that often happen when government people are being tracked or when somebody tries to take their data or different kinds of ways that they communicate that's more protected than you and me. So there's a gazillion things that these government devices have, and you're supposed to interact on government stuff with these government devices. And Hegseth seems not to know that. The fact that he put all these people on Signal, which is more protected than other things that you can use, the content is encrypted, but you can pick up that content even before it gets encrypted. on a non-government device. So there's just so many ways that he's like blown it. And this is not rocket science for government people. Government people, you know, since the beginning of, you know, U.S. time, have known how to protect the kinds of things they do. Does that protection always work? No. But that protection gets you in a better place. So, yeah, it's kind of appalling, Joe.
Let me ask this question. Because I mentioned in the article from the New York Times just a moment ago about this idea of his phone number being readily available on social media and could be found. It's listed. So a fantasy sports line online. I mean, I would think that you said bad actors, so I'll go with that. But if bad actors or even just curious people wanted to find out more information, it seems to be one of the key ingredients of doing that is to know the number of the person of who you are trying to reach.
I think his number is 1-800-LISTEN-IN.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it just seems to me like that's
exactly
half the puzzle.
Right.
Yes.
Think about the number of times you give your phone number and how often your phone is tracked. It's like it makes all of us the targets of stalkers. It's like a big welcome sign. Right. And your phone number, you know, creates digital breadcrumbs everywhere. And the ways you identify yourself create digital breadcrumbs everywhere. And if somebody wants to put all of those pieces together and to track you or to figure out what you're doing or to figure out who your friends are or to figure out what you're interested in, it's easy. It's done every single day about each and every one of us. When, you know, companies market to us or ads are targeted towards us. But imagine that we were in positions of power where we could, you know, start wars or be involved in, decisions of state. It's a clear invitation.
Heather?
Yeah, all I can think, I mean, I feel like Ferris Bueller's in charge of, you know, is the Secretary of Defense. It's like the kid who got the keys to his dad's really cool car, or maybe his friend's dad's really cool car, right?
Yeah.
You know, I just, someone needs to take the guy's phone away. Someone needs to tell him, like, hey, this is a really important job that you have, so maybe you might not want to be bragging to your wife and your brother-in-law about, you know, all the stuff that's going on that is top secret. I just don't understand how there's not some kind of check on this. And by the way, the guy who left, who resigned yesterday, I think the quote from Hegseth was, he's a great American and he's definitely not fired. I'm like, I hope that's not the quote when I leave a job. Like, oh, and she was most definitely not fired.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
It's very supportive. Although, they were planning on figuring out changes within the office. So, obviously, you know, you see the writing on the wall. And by the way, if everybody else is going out, and I can't imagine it was a picnic working there.
No, I mean, the guy's got, and I'm sorry, I should look at and see what his name is. But he's got some other job in the administration that is a part-time.
Yes.
Special government employee, yeah, right. With focus on science, technology, and industry. So it's not like he, you know, he's being run out the door. But I mean, this is a pretty high level position that I think that he's leaving, and it's concerning that people don't want to work at the Pentagon. I mean, it's kind of important.
That's concerning. The other thing that is concerning is that as of now, those positions aren't full. So you have four major positions within Hegseth's immediate circle that aren't there as of right now.
Maybe he's planning on hiring his wife and his brother-in-law, and that's he's trying to get them up to speed. I don't know. Like, yeah. I mean, what I think that especially in military background roles, there's a lot of respect and value placed on discipline, placed on structure, and it seems like that doesn't exist right now in that agency.
I want to go to Philip Glotzbach, but let me just ask you a follow-up. You said, you know, it's time to take his keys away. Is it time to take his job away?
Well, I mean, that's not for me to say. If it was me, if I was the boss, yeah, I'd take his job away. Or I'd demote him and put someone over him as like a, you know, a supervisor or something, you know, because the whole, I mean, the security breaches are very significant. I don't mean, I know we're, I'm kind of being jokey about it, but it's a big deal when you start sharing top secret information with people who don't have clearance. You're placing lives at risk, and as much as you could say, oh, it's my brother, he'd never say anything. Well, you know, the guy, you can't just make that your own judgment. There's a reason why you have the kind of rules and structure around security that exist, and a complete disregard from the top is a terrible message. Which is probably why some of these folks are, you know, looking for the exit doors.
Philip.
Well, we're living in the age of chaos. There's no question about that. But I think we're also living in the age of irony. One of the words that was repeated endlessly in Hegseth's Senate hearing was the word merit. And he talked about merit this and merit that. And it's ironic that he's, I think, one of the least meritorious hires that could be imagined simply because of what he brought to the job or didn't bring to the job, and then now his performance. But, you know, organizations tend to reflect the personalities and values of the leaders, and the president is someone who has shown a completely cavalier attitude towards intelligence, towards secrecy, towards preserving of documents and so on. I mean, just go down the line. So why should Hegseth care about it either? And I think the word is care here. There's just not a lot of care in this administration about the kind of things, you know, Heather, that you were mentioning, or the kind of concerns that anybody reasonably would have. They just don't care. And if they don't care, then you're going to get the behavior that you see.
I was struck by the fact that the, you know, you have even right after this story came out on Sunday, that there were Republican senators saying, look, fun's fun, but if a Democrat did this, we'd be asking for their scalp.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll just say, like, I try not to look at things through a partisan lens, because I think people have a tendency to only see the bad things that people in the other party do and maybe don't recognize it in their own party. And that's, you know, unfortunate, maybe a little hypocritical. But this is just ridiculous. I mean, you can't be texting top secret information. I don't care that Signal is slightly more secure. He's not texting secure information to people with clearance. It's people who are outside outside of the government. And that's just not right. That's, to me, that is a huge breach. And I think, you know, I'm not surprised that he felt that he was qualified for the position. I think that, you know, there's a lot of people think they're qualified for things that they're not qualified for. Yeah, right. Of course I can. I wish I had that. I wish I had that kind of, I don't know, fortitude.
It's more of a male thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
No, I always, you know, if someone says I did something wrong, I always believe them. and then I have to kind of roll back the tape and think about it. But yeah, where's the self-awareness here that this is an important job? No, he's not acting like it's an important job.
Well, and there's also the two sides of this, which I find, I mean, now we go vaguely psychological here, but one of the things that has been told to him over and over again, that one of the reasons he got the job and one of the reasons that Trump likes him is because he is so in your face and screaming and yelling at the press about what they've done and so forth. And I get that, but I don't think that's helping his cause, because he's now just saying that, like, you know, this isn't classified information. Well, yes it is.
How is
that? Yeah, but you know, give me a break. I mean, it does seem like anybody who comes into government service has to understand the importance of security. Of security of information and all of that, even if things are a mess under the covers. The Pentagon is, you know, stop one for a place where secure information is really has to be important, has to be respected, and it has to start from the top down. and including all of the other ways in which the current set of folks may not be up to the demands of their job, this is just, you know, square one in terms of what you have to do to really do your job at any level. And just it's just so surprising to me and appalling that no doubt he got all kinds of briefings that said, you got to carry this, you got to carry that. And, you know, in his infinite wisdom, he decides that signal's okay, right, to plan this thing. And to plan the thing on Yemen and to do all of the other things and to use his phone to, you know, get on fantasy football or whatever else, you know, buy on Amazon or whatever he's doing. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me that we would keep him in his job and we would put the U.S. in danger in this way.
Just quickly, we talk about national security and Fran, I agree with everything you just said. But it can sound like an abstract concept. And I think in the last election, a lot of voters just ignored it or discounted it as, you know, why should we worry about this? But in truth, and as people have said, he's putting lives at risk, individual lives. He put at risk the people who were flying the mission to Yemen. But he's also putting lives at risk of people who have sensitive positions in the military. He's putting at risk, ultimately, the security of the United States. So it's where the rubber hits the road, it really is risking very concrete results that could be very bad.
I mean, it's I am saying this without data, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. The number of times our security is breached in some sort of serious way far outweighs the number of times we actually send service people to war. And it's happening all the time. It's happening every day. It's happening in every country in the world. Other people are doing espionage on the U.S. The U.S. is doing espionage on all other countries in the world. This is part of the world we live in, and it's really important for people at Hegseth's level and all the people that report to him to understand the landscape that we're in.
It's a when you think of this too, of the, you know, the security aspects, but also just many thinking that. And again, I think Republicans and Democrats saying that he should lose his job. And yet the president spent the first part of this week, until he didn't, talking about how Jerome Powell should be losing his job. That was the focus. And so, I mean, that does give you some insight, right?
He backed off on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I said until he didn't.
Yeah, because he realized, oh, wait.
I'm tanking the stock market.
Right. So I can blame him if he stays.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can blame him if he goes. I can blame him if he stays.
Yeah. Well, they appointed him.
Yes. I mean, yes. That's the other thing. But, I mean, that's the – so you try to think of, like, what did you do that was so bad that would get Jerome Powell fired? Okay, well, we just talked about this. This is, you know
– Well, he didn't really mean it.
Scapegoat.
Yeah.
And then you go, yes. He didn't mean calling him a loser. I understand.
I was surprised Hegseth actually made it through at the beginning because there was so much controversy about him. But also, I mean, I think, you know, one of the criticisms of prior administrations is that the perception globally, and I am definitely paraphrasing what the president has said. I may be making it a little bit more coherent than what he said, but basically he has said that if you have a strong military and a strong presence globally, these wars would not have happened, right? And so given that, I would think that disorganization and chaos at the Department of Defense, at the Pentagon, is the last thing he would want, because that's completely counter to, you know, his statement that, you know, under me, we're perceived as strong and no one would dare enter into a conflict. It wouldn't have happened if I was in charge. That's, you know, his take on Ukraine. I think this is a complete opposite. This is, the department is in chaos. It's in disarray. It's certainly not a secret that's just, you know, we're not the only ones talking about this. Globally, people are aware that there's a problem. That, to me, is more of an opening for, you know, world conflict.
Well, there's a problem only if you care about consistency. And that's not a value that this administration has embraced or that the president has embraced.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will bring in listener letters and move on to other topics as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Radios and Radio and Rainbows is the title track off Kay Pearson's brand new album, which is out in called Radio and Rainbows. And Kay Pearson will be joining us coming up about 11:30 this morning, and we're very excited about that. She'll also be doing a gig at City Winery in the Hudson Valley, and we'll talk about that as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, to get in your thoughts on the topics of the day. We have started with the Pete Hegseth topic, and we'll be moving on shortly. But let me get to a few letters from our listeners, and then we will go on from there. Kurt says, none of Trump's group has a family member flying a bomber. Obviously, no member of the cabinet has a family member put in danger by the cavalier attitude towards mission information. Then we go to Claire, who says, I have a friend who has level 4 clearance and works in a facility in New York. They cannot be reached by personal phone or text during the workday. They cannot discuss their work other than in the most generic of terms. Otherwise, they would be fired. And Hegseth has violated all of this. Jeesh, I feel safe. I certainly feel safe with him in charge. That is from Claire. Theodore writes, can Congress remove the Secretary of Defense?
No idea. I don't think so.
I don't think so.
They'd possibly be impeached, but that would require, I don't know.
That would require a lot of work.
Right.
Yes.
And time.
And political maneuvering that may or may not be there.
I'm gonna Google it.
Yes.
Because Google knows everything.
That's right. we Google so you don't have to, listeners. Eric
thinks it knows everything.
Erica says, I find in life that those who adamantly convince you of their riches, their deeds, good or bad, or their intelligence actually do not carry any of those qualities in abundance. I also want to say that the thing the military beats into your brain for your entire career is integrity. For those who don't know, that means doing the right thing or good things when no one is there to witness or commend you for it. He is a disgrace to the uniform. That from Erica.
Okay, so Vice President, President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah, so impeachment.
So, yeah, impeachment is the way. They can't actually fire him.
Right. He serves at the pleasure of the president.
Yeah, I don't know if signing up for fantasy football on your device is a high crime and misdemeanor. But
well, it depends
it
if you win.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and who you're. And who you're
yeah.
Sounds like a misdemeanor to me.
Yeah.
Misdemeanor. Okay.
All right. So, anyone else on this subject? If not, hearing none, we'll move. We will move on. I will quickly say from JR, I was more careful with the Rotten Gun Club roster information than these clowns are with military and national security issues. That from JR. It's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people put themselves in the position of the information that they possess and they're in charge of and the pains that they take to keep that information secure, no matter how important it may or may not be.
So, I don't know, but I feel like we all have that friend that if you tell them a secret, you know they're going to share the information. Like, he's the guy. If you want it to come out,
yes.
You tell him, like, you can't tell anyone, but yeah.
It's a very, very good point.
Maybe. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I do think you're right in the sense that there is always that person. And I think just looking at, well, first of all, I mean, anyone who with, like, I was, maybe I won't go down this road because I was going to say, I mean, his background was Fox News. So,
right.
I mean, that's like, that's what they do, right?
Yeah, get information out.
You know, out, yeah.
Yeah.
Get the information and then put it out, whether.
Yeah.
Or misinformation.
Well, that's what I was going to say, whether it's accurate or not. I mean, right. That's. Yeah.
But their orientation is to share information. It's for, I mean, right. Whether or not it's accurate or not, I'm setting that aside.
Right.
If your lifelong role has been to report, to share, to dig up and share information, this is like kind of the opposite.
Well, he was a soldier, and I think, what, in Iraq, and so in, and I think involved in real operations. So at the time, he would have appreciated the value of keeping information where it's supposed to be. I believe that's true. So apparently not any longer.
Yeah.
Well. All right. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's talk about education and higher education, and we'll start with Harvard, although we'll have other schools and other topics to discuss as we go down this road. As Harvard is hailed a hero, some donors still want it to strike a deal. That's the headline from the New York Times. To much of academia, many on the left and some on the right, Harvard is a hero for standing up to the White House and rejecting its demands to reshape academic and student life. After weeks of major law firms and other prestigious institutions like Columbia University acquiescing to President Trump's demands, Harvard, in the eyes of Mr. Trump's critics, had become the backbone of the resistance. The Harvard Corporation, the secretive board that runs the school, said the list of charges, excuse me, check that, said the list of changes the White House demanded in a letter on April 11th were so onerous, requiring faculty power to be reduced and government audits of university data, that the school would not agree to any of them and broke off talks with the administration. Since then, Harvard has held firm. Last week, White House and administration officials made at least three overtures to a Harvard representative in an attempt to restart talks. The school's leadership rebuffed them all, according to two people with knowledge of the outreach. Most, but not all, members of the Harvard Corporation, emboldened in part by the positive reaction in the school's combative response to the White House, are adamant that they will not so much as negotiate with Mr. Trump. On Monday, Harvard filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration in federal court challenging its threats to slash billions of dollars from the school's funding. But the Harvard Corporation is in many ways an unwitting hero. For weeks leading up to the April 11th letter, the corporation took a very different stance toward the Trump administration. At the urging of some of its biggest donors, the corporation frantically tried to cut a deal with Mr. Trump. Harvard hired the same lawyer that the law firm Paul Weiss used to make its deal with Mr. Trump. Over the past month, as it became clear that Mr. Trump was ratcheting up pressure on Harvard, the school's president, Dr. Alan Garber, looked for other ways into the White House, including a potential meeting with Mr. Trump himself. Jared Kushner was called in, a Harvard alum and the president's son-in-law, to ask for help. Mr. Kushner said he could not offer that assistance. Philip Glotzbach, where are we in this? And because now it's, I mean, the whole thing is really a mess because it's the, they didn't mean to send the letter. And then they said they would have sent the letter anyway, but they were still hoping. And they didn't understand why Harvard didn't reacted the way they did. And Harvard said, well, we got a letter. It was on letterhead. It was signed by three people. We thought, you were serious. And they said, well,
it looked like a letter.
Well, you should have known better because we were negotiating. And then the president comes the $2 billion, and then we'll do another $1 billion perhaps. And, oh, by the way, you may lose your tax-exempt status.
Right. Let me make three quick points, and then we can go on from there. I think the first thing that Harvard certainly is aware of or should be aware of is that making a deal with this president is probably not worth the paper it's written on. And apparently there's been no paper. If you look at the large law firms like Paul Weiss that did those deals, now they're finding out that their understanding wasn't exactly what the president understood or what he's now claiming it is. And so, you know, it's hard to know even what a deal looks like in this environment. The second thing is that colleges and universities, and even the big ones like Harvard, are dealing with a fundamental dilemma at the heart of what colleges and universities are in this country. It was expressed very, very well by Brian Rosenberg, who's a former president of McAllister College, in a nice book that he wrote recently. But the dilemma is that we expect colleges and universities to operate on the basis of principles. And that's something that was always something very important to me, and I think it's important to every president and so many people in the academy. And once you depart from those principles, you're in trouble. We are value-driven organizations. But at the same time, we're expected to operate like businesses. And what Rosenberg says is when you start to operate like a business, you get criticized for not operating on the basis of value. Well, Harvard is a business in its own way, and so it's understandable, I suppose, that the corporation is concerned about the loss of all these funds. But let me come back to that the third point here, and that is that the values have to be paramount. And at any response to the current situation, I think, by any president, and let me just say, I'm no longer the president of Skidmore College, so anything I say is I'm a civilian here. It's nothing. Yep. It's not from the college at all. But I think that anything that a college or university president does or says in response to the current situation needs to start with an articulation of the basic values of the academy, of its institution, and of the academy in general. You start from there. Everything else follows from those values, and you have to be consistent with those values. And there's a lot you can do and say if you start from that position.
Fran, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, and I was really, I'm glad you started with Phil because I was really interested in his point of view on this. To me, you know, when I read the New York Times article, what struck me is the interplay that happens at every university between trying to make a university successful in terms of its mission and the culture that needs to be aligned with promoting its mission, and it needs to be successful as a business. All colleges and universities need to, you know, make enough money and keep the infrastructure going and pay faculty and, you know, keep the buildings up. And as a faculty member, that's hard to know. And it isn't something I really realized until for a while. Some of you will remember that I was VP for research at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And it really gave me a bird's eye view of how many moving parts universities have and the role of money in supporting all of the things that the university does. And so when we look at Harvard, you can see that the corporation is really worried about these money aspects, which Harvard, even though it has a huge endowment, the colors of money, which is to say, it's not like that's a big bank account. Different parts of that money are reserved for different kinds of things. And so there's a lot of pressure from folks in the corporation to negotiate so the hit won't be as hard. On the other hand, I have to say, as a member of higher education sector, which has been pretty grim for the last 3 months, this notion that something that, you know, kind of arguably has been a crown jewel of the United States educational system, despite, you know, all of our cracks, really, you know, has been taken down in a very thorough way. And the fact that, you know, Harvard's going through this negotiation on the inside between the people who want the business to be okay and the people who want the mission to be okay, I think it's just, it's heroic. And at least it looks like a hero from the outside. And I think as a person at a public university, UMass Amherst, it's given a lot of us really, you know, hope and a little inspiration to kind of push back in places where it's inappropriate for the federal government to be micromanaging this sector. And so it's really interesting to me to watch both those things happening, Harvard trying to sustain itself as a business and thrive, and Harvard trying to take up the gauntlet and say, no, this isn't okay.
Yeah, I have some really mixed feelings about all of this because, yes, Harvard, I think one of the difficulties I have is Harvard is a not-for-profit, and yet they have a $53 billion endowment that they're sitting on. And, as someone who myself runs a not-for-profit, I can tell you we do not, if I had that kind of money and my mission is to improve the business climate, I would be spending it on improving the business climate and leaving it other than, some kind of reasonable reserve sitting in a rainy day fund is not the way to go. Now, there's that some of that fund is for research, for really, really beneficial things. But I struggle with the idea of, the concerns that are laid bare about the money that they're going to lose from the federal government, the $1 billion, when they're sitting on $53 billion in money and none of their assets are taxable. It's a hard thing for me to wrap my brain around. I mean, I have a lot of for-profit businesses that are in my membership. But we also have colleges and universities that don't have nearly the resources that Harvard does, that, struggle to keep their doors open and at the same time are struggling with how can we keep tuition low enough to keep it affordable for our students so they don't take on too much debt going through undergrad. And it's a real concern. I mean, obviously, everyone's talked about student debt burden and all of that. I mean, with this kind of money and the $1 billion, they should either be much bigger than they are, or tuition should be free or something like that. But that's a very oversimplified view. I don't run a university. I can only think of it in the context of running a relatively small nonprofit in the state of New York. All of that being said,
Heather?
I find it alarming that all of this information about these conversations that took place between the board members are laid bare in a news publication. I mean, that to me, I mean, that is it. It's not at all surprising that they would have concerns, that they would have conversations about what do we do. And board members should be able to do that without being worried about it being printed in The New York Times or The Washington Post. I don't remember which paper had this. So I mean, that's a secondary takeaway that I have from the article that might not be obvious. But as someone who, has a board and also sits on a board, you don't want to see some of the direct conversations be reprinted in the paper. How can you have a real board discussion and talk about what the real concerns are if there's somebody in the room who's going to go report it to The New York Times?
But Heather, I have two things to say,
yeah.
And one of them is a question for you. Start with the one about the board. I just think anytime you have a bunch of people together, things leak. And this is sort of back to the Hicks.
As you said before, there's always that one person.
There is always that one person. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, things just leak, and so really, if you don't want people to know stuff, in some sense, people always can know stuff, and today we're we have digital means as well as actual people telling things. But, I think it's not surprising to me that these conversations came out, and it wouldn't be surprising to me if they weren't completely accurate either. But the other thing I wanted to ask you is, I do think that, and I know for a fact that all $53 billion that they have is not in their general fund. But the thing I don't know, and maybe you do, is how much is.
Oh,
because,
I don't know.
As you know well, when you give money, if I gave, like I had this, $5 billion to Harvard, and I said...
That's restricted, yeah.
And I said, it's only for the ultimate Frisbee team, and you can't spend it on anything else.
Maybe that's what this
and,
is.
And, they can't spend it on, helping somebody with their tuition or, vital life-saving, cancer treatment. They have to spend it on ultimate Frisbee. It's my money, and that's the conditions under which I gave it to them.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. I agree with that.
Yeah.
It is the single largest endowment amongst educational institutions in the world.
Yeah,
in the world. It's not, you know, it's not like, oh, all of these schools have, you know, $50 billion in an endowment. This is very, they're somewhat of an outlier. I think the next highest is maybe Yale, and it's like $40 billion. But it's on scale. Harvard's endowment is massive. I can't believe it's all restricted, and hopefully not to ultimate frisbee.
Yeah, I mean, that, I don't know, maybe one of our listeners knows how much of it is, you know, if everything except $500 million is restricted, they're really in trouble. I know that's not the case, but I don't know what the balance is.
Yeah,
I don't know what the balance on that is. Probably more is restricted than one would imagine, but they clearly have latitude in how they use it, and some funds are fungible. To this point about the size of the Harvard endowment, I mean, it really is an outlier, and so are the Ivy Leagues. And if you look at the schools with the top endowment, I mean, recently, I can't remember exactly, but a while back I saw, if you take all the private colleges and universities in this country, the average endowment was under $50 million, certainly, maybe under $30 million. So there are a lot of schools with tiny endowments. So, you know, Harvard is not the world. But let me say a couple things about the Harvards of the world.
Can I hold you on that? Just because we have to take a break at the top of the hour. So we'll come back to this, and we'll get back into this conversation. Mm-hmm. We'll add some other stories that are related as well. We'll take a break and be right back. First News with Ray Graff.
It was clear to me that we would always be always, always till now.
Listening to Kate Pearson on this Friday morning from the new album Radio and Rainbows. That is a great song called Always Till Now, and is one of the few laundromat songs that I know.
That's
great.
I feel like I'm having this urge to do laundry.
Yeah,
right now.
It's just very, very good.
I love that line.
Great laundromat song. All right. And Kate Pearson will be with us at 11:30. Okay. So let me tell you who is here right now, and we are delighted to have them all here. Fran Berman, Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences. Former Skidmore College President Philip Glotzbach and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Philip, I unfortunately had to cut you off at the top, but you were getting ready to go through a list of important things that we should know.
Right. I'll try to do that. I was starting to defend Harvard.
Yes.
And I think that it's appropriate to do that. First thing I just want to say is that the mission of schools like Harvard goes beyond teaching its students, which, of course, ought to be at the core of anything. And if you look at the students who are in Harvard, there are far more graduate students, medical students, law students, than there are undergraduates. So it is a very big, complex place, even if you just look at the teaching and learning part of it. But the real mission of a school like Harvard is to do good in the world. And they do it through their research. They do it through the medical research. They do it through all the different ways in which they create knowledge that turns out to be useful. And as the Trump administration is pulling back money in all kinds of ways from these research efforts, not just at Harvard, but at every research university and many, many colleges across the country, they are damaging an operation that has resulted in enormous good. It talks about making America great again. America is great because, in large part, or in some part anyway, because of what had been done by the universities and colleges across the last, you know, half century and more. So Harvard is in a position to negotiate very publicly with the Trump administration, and let's just be honest. There are things that higher education needs to do, and I hope that this moment, first of all, I hope that colleges and universities actually survive with their autonomy intact, the assaults of the Trump administration, and it's not just directed toward the large ones. Now weaponized, and I would defend my use of that term, Department of Education sent a Dear Colleague letter to colleges and universities across the country, which informed them, although with the footnote it says this letter does not have the force of law, but it sure sounded like it if you read the letter, that they need to stop all their DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work, and so on, a whole laundry list of things they need to stop doing. And then the Trump administration goes after these larger schools on the basis of trying to root out anti-Semitism, which one might say is actually a diversity and equity initiative. Let's be clear about that. Trying to make universities safe places for Jewish students, which is an absolutely important value. So there are things that colleges and universities really need to do. They have lost their lofty reputation, which they held for many years, deservedly or not. But along with so many other institutions over the last decade, they have taken a real hit. And now public opinion polls show that more people distrust colleges and universities, are not confident that they're doing what they should do and so on, that they, quote, push political agendas, so on. More people hold those positions than don't hold them. This polling skews according to party affiliation. More Republicans are more critical of colleges and universities than Democrats, but even Democrats are critical of this. And so colleges and universities need to regain this moral ground. They need to make it clear what they're doing to promote access and to students who, particularly in the middle class, colleges and universities do a very good job of accommodating students from wealthy families and from very poor families. They do a less good job about accommodating families in the middle, and that's really a matter of money. Harvard, Princeton, schools like that with these enormous endowments can do more to help families in the middle range. But again, they take very relatively few students compared to everybody. There has to be more focus across the board on teaching and learning.
So I know that this is a loaded word, but did Columbia cave?
Columbia caved. They did. They caved. They caved.
Columbia caved. I mean, Columbia had problems before, and
yes.
God, I just saw the New York Times article this morning about Barnard faculty being asked if they're Jewish, and you know how religious are they, and you know all this kind of stuff. And I have a very good friend who's faculty at Barnard. And, you know, I texted my friend and asked, did you get this? And, yeah, this is the state that we're in, that the administration is fishing to see if they can create more things to bat Columbia on the head with. And I completely agree with Phil. And let it be known, universities have been struggling for a really, really long time. Our business model is broken. Our infrastructure is expensive, and that's just not faculty and buildings. That's labs and computers and all the kinds of things we need to do modern work. At some point, we can't ask students to pay any more tuition. Excuse me. If you're a private university or a private college, you don't really have as much access to state funds, which go to public universities. There's not that many state funds. Since 2009, you know, universities have been struggling for research funds. They've been struggling for philanthropy. They've been struggling for the money that they need to run a more expensive operation than they used to. That being said, and all of those things are broken, and universities have been struggling, as the rest of the country has, with DEI, with a situation that was very, very unfair for a long time. How do you make it more fair? You know, is the thumb too much more on the other side of the scale? Is it not? Universities struggle with those kinds of issues. They struggle with free speech. They struggle with academic freedom, just like everybody else. So it's not like going into this, we were kind of okay. We were just struggling with the scale and the dynamics of our time. But taking universities down is really not the solution. And, you know, kind of figuring out what is a business model that makes more sense at this time, and how can we do things? And doing those with the administration would be great. That's just not an option, and we're going in the other direction. So I have to say, and, you know, be interested in Phil and Heather's thoughts on this as well, but it's heartbreaking to me. And I'll tell you all, I am teaching this semester, and I have students in my classes who are not from the U.S., who are worried about their visas being taken away,
yeah.
Who are worried about people coming to their dorm and sending them to God knows where. UMass, like many other schools are worrying about, like, how do we let those students finish their degrees? And Columbia was first. And Columbia was pretty broken. But Columbia was still, you know, functioning and trying to deal with that.
Yeah.
Sorry about this, you guys. I am so devastated by what's happening.
Don't be sorry. No,
arguably one of the crown jewels of America.
So I think what we didn't really talk about the fact that, you know, the money that is being yanked from Harvard, I think a lot of that is research funding. And one of the strengths and one of the reasons that the United States is at the cutting edge of innovation in medical, in technology, in virtually every field is because of the amount of money that goes into research. And people who are researching, generally speaking, are not working directly for the federal government. The people who are working in research, I mean, we can nitpick because the funding comes, maybe that's, you know, how they're categorized, but they're via universities, higher education, that do some of the critical research that has really placed our economy at the forefront in the world. And to me, if you're saying, well, we're going to take away your funding because that's the tool that we have, because we don't like how you've handled, you know, protest
student
on your campus. I mean, that's like saying, well, we see that you've got this ingrown hair, so we're going to cut off your arm. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's using a much, much bigger tool to accomplish that. And to that end, I think that some of this is it's frustration that, you know, conservative voices maybe weren't as welcome on some of these campuses. And those are things I think that higher education could have handled a lot better. But I think it's really important that government not have a say in what curriculum looks like, in how these entities operate, as long as they're operating within a set of rules where they're treating voices equally. And if that was the problem that you identified, this is not the solution. The solution is to have a real discussion, and you know, basically get some of these universities to agree to be more welcoming to voices that they don't necessarily agree with, and to manage you know, some of the protests in a way that they're not threatening to students who have every right to be there, but who happen not to be in agreement with whatever the issue of the day is. And I'm not minimizing those issues. I think all voices deserve to be heard, but you can't allow just one voice to shout down the rest of the voices. Whether or not you agree with them, it's just that is a real legitimate, I think, criticism of the schools. But again, this solution of yanking their funding, which is primarily for research, is just not the right solution.
You're retired, Philip. You're not beholden to anyone. What is this really about?
Oh, it's about control. It's about Trump and his administration wishing to control these institutions that themselves have independence. And you know, I agree with Heather. There are a lot of things that need to be improved in colleges and universities today. But this is about imposing your will. And Trump and his people, J.D. Vance and so on, have long attacked colleges and universities. Vance called them, quote, the enemy. In speeches prior to being elected, they're looking at the Viktor Orban model in Hungary, and even what's happened in Florida. So it's really, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric about freedom of speech and freedom, but what's really happening is that this is an attempt to stifle independent thought and independent voices that are represented in colleges and universities. And let me just say, if you really want to, I'll go back to what Heather was saying. It's absolutely right. To address issues of anti-Semitism and to try to do a better job of managing the things that you were talking about. And I think colleges and universities do need to do a better job of that. You need to have discussions about those issues, which, if you read what the Trump administration has said in the Dear Colleague letter, you can't do it because you're restricted from using the vocabulary that those discussions would require. And so I think this whole focus on anti-Semitism is entirely pretextual, even though there are issues there. Let me just make one last point here. Excuse me. This is an inflection point in colleges in our country in so many ways. If we don't come out of this with a broader understanding between faculty members and administrations at our colleges and universities that they need to work together to address these issues, freedom of speech, academic freedom, and a whole range of other things, one of the most important ones being education for citizenship, which is not part of the conversation. The last thing I believe the Trump administration wants is better education for informed, responsible citizenship. Colleges and universities should be doing a better job of that. But so there are a lot of things that colleges and universities need to be doing. That what the Trump administration is threatening them with and has in fact done is not helping to achieve those goals.
And if you are trying to force a political agenda onto an independent college and university, you could see how well that's worked in other countries. Name me all the great higher educational institutions in, you know, the former Soviet Union.
Right.
Or I mean, those are the kinds of governments that do this stuff, not democracies.
So is a step to that which we saw in the executive order earlier this week in targeting college accreditors?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I've read what's been reported about that. Yes, it is. Again, Trump has been critical of accreditation because he's claimed that the accreditation as it has existed for the past number of years has imposed upon colleges and universities a left-wing ideological agenda. There are some places where you might find some evidence for that, not much. The reporting in the New York Times was really pretty interesting to me because they got a lot of things wrong. For one thing, they talked about accreditors as businesses, and they're not businesses; they're organizations. That was a word they used.
And they're peers a lot of times.
Yes.
Yeah, they're peer review.
It's all peer review.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah.
These are independent organizations that do this work.
Was Trump University accredited?
No.
No. Okay. No. Just asking.
So I mean, some are saying that sort of pushing this whole thing of one of the reasons was that was a sticking point.
Right. Well, you know, it certainly did not deserve to be accredited, and in fact was a criminal enterprise. So, you know, it was fraudulent.
Imagine if you went to a doctor or a lawyer, and there were new accreditors that just decided there was some other criteria by which they were legitimate doctors or lawyers. And he's trying to take down, I think, the entire ecosystem that supports quality education at universities.
Yes, he's trying to remove
their independence. Right. I mean, these are peer-reviewed.
Yes.
These are assessment that they're treating students appropriately. You know, they're just not your standard bad guys, really.
I have chaired accreditation visits to different colleges, and I can tell you that the process is a very serious process, and it does look at all aspects of the functioning of the college, from the financial to what's happening in student life to what's happening in classrooms and so on. And schools take those exercises seriously, and there are times when accreditation has been placed in question for institutions who have not met those standards, and those are educational standards. So the system, again, no human system is perfect here. There are a lot of things that one might say, but the system does work well, and I agree with Fran's point that by trying to replace this with something else, they're really undermining the integrity of the entire higher education system. And by the way, colleges and universities are not the only, and community colleges are not the only institutions that are accredited. Secondary schools, primary school systems are also accredited. So talking about all that.
So we just have a few minutes before the bottom of the hour, and I want to sneak in as many letters as I can from our listeners. Mark says, are public colleges and universities under the same threat? Would public colleges and universities in red states be more likely to accept Trump's demands than public colleges and universities in blue states like New York and California?
Well, they would feel more pressure, and they have felt the pressure, and they have taken steps. Again, Florida's a model.
Then we go to
ahead, Fran. Let me just say one more thing, though. When you think about a college and university, you know, we're all sort of competing for the same kind of national ranking about quality. And so every university is trying to get accomplished faculty in, you know, any number of areas. Certainly, I'm in computer science. It's like everybody would die for good AI people these days. And so you want to go, and as a good AI person, I'm not an AI person, but as a good AI person, you would want to go to the best possible university you could. It has to do with the kind of research, the kind of teaching, you know, where you want to live, et cetera. So, the quality, I mean, accreditation isn't just a state-level thing. And in fact, I know many people who are really feel like, as part of that picture of what they want, the kind of the quality of the university matters everything.
And also, public institutions of higher education receive massive amounts of federal research dollars, and so absolutely, they would be at risk if that is the connector that is giving the leverage to the federal government to say you can't do this, you can't do that. There's really not a big difference between public and private as far as the flow of the research dollars.
That's right. It's massive. But my only point here, and I have enormous respect for state institutions. If we did not have them, we could not educate the range and number of students we do every year. They do massive, very, very important work. But they are not only subject to the federal government pressures that we're seeing played out on a daily basis in the papers, but they're also subject to pressures from state legislatures, which have their own dynamics. And one last point here, we talk about public institutions. The funding that state governments provide for their so-called public colleges has been reduced enormously over the past three or four decades. Typically, they receive less than 20% of their funding from the state. And so they have to make that up on their own, whether it's tuition fees and their own fundraising. So it's a very complicated picture.
Real quick.
Yeah, Phil is right. I've been at both public institutions and private institutions. I was at UC San Diego for a long time in the huge, massive University of California system. Now I'm at UMass Amherst in the big UMass system. And I was at RPI, which was a private institution. And that feels exactly right. That interplay of where you get revenue, there's a lot of subtleties in the difference between public and private, and the expectations that you are going to be there for the students in your state. And so these are complicated things, and it's not just you could get an accreditor that believes something different about DEI, and somehow that gives you something different.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and finish up this go-round of the show. We'll do that after this break and news. Without you, I can't face it on my own. So take me back to the party, baby. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Heather Mulligan, Philip Glotzbach, and Fran Berman with us. We have a few moments before I go to before we round out this morning. Let me just read a letter or two, and then we'll move on. Devorah says, I have two large concerns. Threatening to take away research funding is just another way to stamp out science. I am bothered by the supposed pretext as well of cracking down on anti-Semitism. It sounds too much like 1939. How long before people begin to blame Jewish educators, read as liberal/evil, for causing these problems at universities? Fran, would you like to check in on that?
Yeah, yikes. First of all, I completely agree about science. I mean, there's a really, I don't know how many of our listeners have ever heard of the tire track diagram, but a bunch of years ago, probably decades ago, what it did is it traced scientific discoveries to all of the products and services that we use. And so you can imagine, the invention of the light bulb, Tesla, the telephone, and all of that leading ultimately to the internet and all of the things we do today. You can think about, all of these mathematical theorems that nobody thought had anything to do with anything, and then discovering the creation of materials or all the things we do. Science is the way we invent the future. And it solves problems we don't know anything about, and it ultimately gives us the bridges we drive over, the cars we drive over with them, our entire infrastructure of the world we live in, all of those satellites out in space that let you use your cell phone. So, you know, it's hard to see science kind of sullied every time something doesn't work out. You know, science doesn't mean certainty. Science is the best explanation we have so far for solving a question we have or a problem we want to understand. And it gets better and better over time. And so where does science happen? Well, the most unencumbered place science happens is at the universities. It's not like science doesn't happen at Pfizer or Google or, you know, lots of other places, but often those places are ultimately looking for the ideas they have to ultimately pan out in the short to medium term with discoveries that can make them money. But the place that people, even for those companies, are trained and universities in general, the professional scientists there, are really now under attack. And not only is it crappy that they're under attack, but how it's going to hold us back as a society to deal with the problems of the world we live in, to me, is appalling. So that part of it, I really understand. The other part of the letter, I think about, you know, blaming Jewish people for this stuff. I do think that the use of DEI and anti-Semitism is just a really giant bludgeon. You know, to me, this isn't about DEI, and it isn't about anti-Semitism, although both exist in plus or minus spaces in universities as they do in lots of organizations. To me, these are just bludgeons, you know, to take out universities as a sector because, you know, why? I don't know. They're independent. They're not easy to control. Lots of other reasons that are far from me. But I have to say, I don't really think of these things as specifically as the letter writer does myself. But I do think that, you know, they've just been used willy-nilly to kind of conk us all over the head and try to, you know, put us on leash.
Bill?
Absolutely right. You know, why is this assault on science? Where does this come from? And if you back up and look at what Trump is trying to do to establish his power as an autocrat and the people who are supporting him creating autocracy, and there's a class of people who've been writing about this, and it's just all there. Because facts represent limits. If I am a leader and I acknowledge that there are certain facts that are well established now, then I can't change that. If I want to make a statement that's contradicted by those facts or contradicted by the best science today, then that's a limit to my power. And so autocrats in general, and Trump in particular, and he's done this forever. He talked about the birther stuff with Obama. It's a way of establishing power and denying that there's anything out there that could check or limit your power. And so it's not surprising that he has always been skeptical about science, and that the attacks on science have been continuous, and that he's put people like Robert Kennedy in charge of scientific operations, where the only possible outcome is to weaken those operations to make them less effective, and that's already happening.
I'm just bummed out about my Fruit Loops. That's all. No.
Yeah, they're going to take on a different.
Oh, yeah, you should.
Yeah, well, those are going away, pal.
There you go.
I actually don't
get
eat
the blue
Fruit
ones
Loops.
Here. Just saying, Heather.
There's a blueberry Pop Tarts, too, I think, that will be impacted. So, yeah. Well, that's science, right?
We figured that out somehow. That's right.
He might do some things that are good. I'll grant
it
you
is
that.
True. I did just return from Europe, and it's funny the differences between the products that are available here and available there. And by the way, there's no Diet Coke in Europe. It's all Coke Zero.
Oh, but no, there's Coca-Cola Light, right?
Oh, there might be Coca-Cola Light. I didn't see that, though.
It's a different formula, though. Yeah. It doesn't taste the same. Yeah.
There are limits to.
And by the way, I don't recall seeing the blue Fruit Loops on the tire track diagram, but I'll look a little closer.
Yeah, give it a shot. Deborah writes and says authoritarian regimes always go after intellectuals and universities, pretending that they care about Jews is a lie. They align with white supremacists and the Proud Boys. It will actually make Jews greater targets, according to Deborah. Then we go to this from Bob. Sad to say, Heather, but the U.S. isn't really on the cutting edge in several critical areas. China is eating our lunch in robotics and solar panels and electric cars, just to name a few. The American model for innovation isn't working the way it used to.
That's a manufacturing thing. I think the technology very frequently still does come from the United States or originates in the U.S. You know where actually there's a huge amount of innovation per capita is Israel. Israel actually has more publicly traded companies on the NASDAQ. I think that's the one that's the, you know, kind of startup-y companies or the tech companies. But then all of Europe combined, like think about that. This is a country with, what, like 6 million, 8 million people?
Small.
It's not a big country, and yet the innovation coming out of there. And some of that is because of their higher education, and actually a lot of that is because of their mandatory military service, which gets people into doing a lot of very technical work who might not have otherwise. But that is all sort of an aside. But I think as far as manufacturing of, you know, advanced manufacturing, yes, there are other countries that have gotten ahead of us on the curve. But in terms of creating innovative, I guess, doing innovative research, I think we're still at the lead.
And let me just say that the both China and Israel are arguments for the kind of positive government education, industry cooperation and collaboration that is more difficult in this country in some ways because of this ideology that half of our population has absorbed since going back to Reagan, that government is somehow the problem. If you assume that government is a problem, then it's very hard to imagine how government can work effectively with industry to do things like this, which in fact we have done, but we could do better. And we need to understand that when people think about the government in those ways, it leads to Elon Musk with his chainsaw. Let's just get rid of large swaths of it, regardless of what they're doing, positive, negative, whatever. So we need to change that ideology. And if we were to do that, we might be able to come back and make the progress that many times we've made in the past.
Let us end our time together with this story because I just want to talk about, I want to say the words Garden of American Heroes. I think that sounds very cool. The National Endowment for the Humanities announced on Thursday a grant program to support President Trump's National Garden of American Heroes, the first concrete step toward realizing one of his central priorities for the 250th anniversary of American independence. The garden, which was announced during Mr. Trump's first term, will feature lifelike renderings of 250 great individuals, quoting here, 250 great individuals from America's past who have contributed to our cultural, scientific, and political heritage, end quote, according to the news release. The endowment is now requesting a preliminary concepts for individual statues from artists who must be American citizens. Those who are selected will receive awards of up to $200,000 per statue, which must be made of marble, granite, bronze, copper, or brass. They must depict figures from a long, eclectic list issued in a previous executive order, which included traditional heroes like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Sacagawea, and Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The Wright brothers are on the list, along with Walt Whitman, Kobe Bryant, Julia Child, Johnny Cash, and Hannah Arendt. Mr. Trump has also directed that subjects be depicted in a realistic manner, with no modernist or abstract designs allowed. And while no site for the garden has been determined, it will be a public space where Americans can gather to learn about and honor American heroes. Fran Berman, I know you are you have a conflict of interest in this particular subject, so I will free you from discussing it, given ties with the NIH. So I'll go to Philip.
You know, I want to say two things. This smacks.
By the way, let's clarify that I am. I was appointed by Obama. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Philip.
That's all right.
And I'm also going to scoot after this and let you guys talk about it. But I was appointed by President Obama to the Citizen Council for the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I would say, and I'm still on it, but certainly during the many years that I've been on the NEH, I have so admired the work of the humanities community and the work of the NEH in funding the humanities community. And before I scoot off, and thank you so much, Joe, and it's been so much fun to talk with you, Phil and Heather. But I just want to say, humanities folks, you guys are heroes. And I really appreciate you.
Fran, thank you.
So thanks, guys.
Very, very much. Thanks. Phil.
Just quickly, this smacks of the kind of projects that you see in authoritarian regimes. But, okay, so that being said, the list is very interesting. It's a very eclectic list. I mean, if any list that includes Hannah Arendt, whose major book was on totalitarianism and Eichmann in Jerusalem and so on, but a lot of other people, you know, is it an ideal list? I don't know. But it's a very diverse list. And there are people on this list whose contributions are being systematically erased because schools can no longer, quote, talk about DEI, unquote, which means, okay, no more black history, no more this, that, no more women's history, can't use those words. And so it's a really interesting development if they do this. The people who are in the Sacagawea, their Sitting Bull is on this list.
That's what struck me is that you, in one hand, you're putting out this call for submissions, and on the other hand, while it has been replaced, you're removing Harriet Tubman from your information from the National Park Service. It is fascinating.
It's crazy.
Heather.
I mean, I think I kind of like the list. I wonder, like, how many Trump meme coins do I need to get on the list? Is there some angle there? That's just completely a joke. But I don't think the idea of doing this is a bad idea at all. I think it's a nice idea. And again, I was sort of impressed by the diversity of the folks on the names on the list. No matter what, it could always be more. There could always be others.
But, yes, add to the list.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And also going with, you know, say like Statuary Hall the capital of what could be included. Heather, Philip, you're wonderful. I thank you very, very much. Thanks again to Fran for a really vibrant and wonderful conversation. I appreciate it so much. Have a beautiful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.